additional serologies that you want to check, preoperative, CBC, comprehensive panel, any disease-specific ones, A1C, lipid profiles, and PTINR if they're on Coumadin, because you want to have that corrected, obviously, and bridged with an enoxaparin prior to surgery. Other studies to consider prior to surgery, H. pylori, you know, especially with the gastric bypass, you're going to bypass the majority of the stomach and the first part of the small intestine. So H. pylori infection is usually in the duodenum where you're not going to be able to reach endoscopically. So there's several different ways you can check for H. pylori. It really doesn't matter how you check it, but I think it's important to check it. We do the stool antigen, which the patients aren't always happy to do, but you can check the serum, the blood. But the antibodies, if they're positive, will always stay positive. The one thing about the stool antigen, after you treat them, it'll go to negative. So you're just not going to treat with antibiotics needlessly if they've not actively infected. So we do a stool antigen on everybody. You can also do a biopsy, and there are some institutions that do EGDs on everybody. I'm not really sure why they do that. The only indication I can think of is to have a gastric bypass to check for H. pylori. But I think that is important. The other thing is with the younger and younger women specifically that are having bariatric surgery, bone density is very, very important. We really don't know what the long-term effect on bone density is in these young females. So if it's indicated, a DEXA scan preoperatively is important. The problem is reimbursement. Bariatric surgery is not an indication, so but any female or male over 50, I think you wouldn't go wrong to get a preoperative DEXA scan and then follow that yearly to see. In our cohort that we checked 100 or 150 patients preoperatively, there was a significant decrease in bone density and lean body mass. So the other thing I think is very important is with regards to vitamin and calcium, and that is checking a PTH and vitamin D. You know, you've done a lot of work on vitamin D and vitamin D deficiency. Do you want to talk about what we check and why and how often?
Sure, sure. We do check, as you said, a PTH and a 25-hydroxy vitamin D level prior to surgery, because a significant number of patients who suffer with morbid obesity have a low vitamin D level prior to surgery. So we do try to catch that and supplement that. And then after surgery as well, which we'll talk about a little later, we like to keep a close eye on those levels to make sure they're adequately supplemented after surgery.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, these patients have a lot of adiposity, and vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. It was amazing to me. I mean, almost 40% of our patients preoperative are vitamin D deficient. Right. And clearly, Tasha, they're taking in enough vitamin D in their diet, don't you know, with their I don't think it's a you know, the yogurts and the consumption of the dairy products, I think they're getting enough vitamin D. I'm not sure why. Is it being sequestered in the adipocyte? And when we check the serum, we're just not picking it up. So, but it's not just in the obese. There's a lot of vitamin D deficiency in adults. But it's amazing to me with all the adipocytes that there's such a deficiency. Now, if they are deficient, what do you recommend for treating preoperatively or postoperatively?
We like to use Drizdol, which is prescription strength vitamin D, 50,000 units once weekly, and do a course of that for 12 weeks and then recheck labs and see where they're at and go from there.
Yeah, I think that's very important because both calcium deficiency or vitamin D deficiency can raise your parathyroid hormone.
Right.
So that's why it's important to check both a PTH and a vitamin D. The other thing is we check the metabolic rate using the, we used to use the MedGem, now we use the...
We use a core review, which is another indirect calorimeter.
So it's just a handheld device?
Yep, a handheld device that patients put in their mouth and breathe in and out of this tube for about 10 minutes. And based on the amount of... oxygen inhaled and carbon dioxide exhaled calculates the resting energy expenditure for us.
Yeah, I think that's important because with weight loss, we lose lean body mass and the metabolism decreases. So having a baseline metabolism. Right. And the other thing is, you know, patients say, oh, my metabolism's so low, I can't lose weight. And we can show them that their metabolism is actually good, normal. So, As we talked about in the other program, we can estimate the one's metabolic rate if we don't have a resting energy expenditure available to us, and that's just by taking the patient's weight for females and multiplying that by 8. Mm-hmm. So if Mrs. Smith weighs 200 pounds, she'll need to take in about 1,600 calories to maintain her weight. And for men, it's about 10 calories. So if Mr. Jones weighs 200 pounds, about 2,000 calories to maintain their weight. But you'd be surprised, and we looked on the DEXA scans in those ones preoperative or postoperatively, the significant decrease in lean body mass after bariatric surgery. So that's something to keep an eye on. We talked about Greenfield filter placement. We don't do as many as some other does, but if they do have that problem with a prior DVT or significant venous stasis changes or inability to get out of bed after surgery, I think that's a good strong indication for Greenfield filter. So I think, and we may be a little biased on this, but if there's one thing that we can do to try to decrease their morbidity and get them in the best metabolic shape, you know, decreasing their liver size, getting their blood sugar better controlled, getting their sleep apnea better controlled, is a 5 to 10% weight loss. We've published on this. It is controversial. There's a lot of institutions say, well, if they could lose weight, why are you going to have surgery? But clearly, I think that there's plenty of studies out there that just a modest weight loss can have significant impact on controlling a lot of the medical problems. And people say, well, if they don't lose the weight, do you not allow them to have surgery? No, I mean, we have that goal, and clearly we've shown in a large cohort, the largest cohort that's been published, over 1,000 patients, that a modest weight loss does decrease both major and minor morbidity after bariatric surgery. So I think in a high-risk patient population, I think a modest weight loss is feasible. Because we can lose the weight. Mm-hmm. It's just the hardest part is keeping it off. So Tasha, if you have some time with the patient, what are some quick things that we go through with them and the audience can go through to try to get their patients to lose just a modest amount of weight?
Mm-hmm. If surgery time is nearing, we might, like we said earlier, do the liquid diet. That's a pretty effective way. It also, we might use the protein shakes that they're going to use postoperatively, so it gets them accustomed to that. We use standardized meal plans that we talked about in the previous lecture, just 1,200 to 1,500 calories for women and 1,500 to 2,000 calories for men.
But one thing that you said that I just want to not forget is that the liquid diet not only causes the weight loss, but it also shrinks the liver very nicely. So that's one of the reasons we do put the patients on a liquid diet right prior to surgery.
There's a number of methods we might use, but I think the why is important too. Like you said, the liver, the surgeons have really bought into the fact that
they get
a better view when the liver's smaller. And so we tell the patients that, and I think when they hear that, it makes it more
exactly.
compelling.
Yeah, exactly, because they say, well, if I could lose the weight, why would I do this? But if you can tell them, well, you know, we can all lose weight, it's always keeping it off by medical measurement is the problem. And if you can say that, you know, look, it's going to shrink your liver, get your blood sugar better, get your blood pressure better, then they do buy into that. And also with regards to pre-op weight loss, I think psychologically the patients do much better. You know, they've lost weight, now they're ready to go on the next phase of their life.
Right.
So I do think from all counts, a modest weight loss is beneficial, especially in the high-risk patients.
It shows to their level of commitment and their compliance as well.
Yeah. So we're up to a point where they're ready for surgery. When they consider surgery, there's basically two types of surgical procedures. There's restrictive procedures, and then there's a combination of restrictive and malabsorption. The most common procedure done in the United States today is the gastric bypass, and at Geisinger we do about 97% bypass patients for a variety of reasons we can talk about later. But if we look at the gastric bypass, as I said, it's a combined restrictive and malabsorptive procedure. Our stomach, as we sit here today, is about the size of a football. The surgeons bypass the majority of the stomach and the first part of the small intestine and make the pouch about the size of an egg. So that's the restrictive part. They bring the jejunum up and hook it to that 30 ml pouch or the egg pouch. So food comes down the esophagus into that 30 ml pouch and then out the jejunum. So the majority of the stomach where parietal cells, acid-secreting cells, are produced, and the first part of the duodenum where iron is absorbed and a lot of calcium absorbed is bypassed. That'll become into play in a little bit when we talk about deficiencies. The adjustable gastric band is a purely restrictive procedure. They just put a celastic band around the top part of their stomach, and connected to that is a port very similar to a metaport. And that goes underneath their skin and underneath their adipose sites. And over time, after surgery, when their appetite increases and their weight loss stops from the liquid diet that we put them on, they just come into the office and we can give them, quote unquote, a fill. They just instill saline into this port, which cinches up this band. This is a purely restrictive procedure, although in the gastric bypass, there is changes, hormonal changes, that are very profound and have a big reason for the improvement in insulin sensitivity immediately after surgery, which we'll talk about because there's some changes that need to be made. So that's the magic that the surgeons do. So they come back to the room. The surgery takes about an hour and a half to 2 hours in general. It's done both laparoscopic and open, but the clearly in the United States, most of the gastric bypasses and all of the, by definition, laparoscopic adjustable gastric band are done laparoscopically. A lot of people think that they can't be done, the bypass can't be done laparoscopically. The fact is that most of them are being done laparoscopically. Okay, after surgery, they've made it back to the floor. Everything went well. So what are some things that we do in the perioperative program? The average length of stay, just to tell people, is about 2.2 days. So they're not in the hospital very long. So what can we do to decrease morbidity during that time?
I think one of the big things is continuation of CPAP or BiPAP, which you had mentioned earlier as a way to decrease that risk of sudden death that mm-hmm. patients with obstructive sleep apnea have after undergoing anesthesia. Also, continuing the compression devices, early ambulation, as we touched on earlier, aggressive pulmonary toilet and incentive spirometer. We actually give our patients the incentive spirometer prior to mm-hmm. surgery, and the nurses do a great job of teaching patients how to do that so they know how to do it after they wake up from surgery. They're a little groggy from the anesthesia. It's hard to teach someone how to do that correctly at that point in time. So our patients get it ahead of time. They know how to use it afterwards. Right, right. We touched on the low molecular weight heparin as well. And diligent blood sugar control. Blood sugar levels can normalize quite rapidly after surgery, so we keep a close eye on that. Check glucose levels during the surgical procedure about an hour into surgery. If it's greater than 150, we start an insulin drip at that point in time, which may stay on board for the first 24 hours, mm-hmm. And we'll continue to check AccuChecks during that perioperative period.
Good. And the most important thing we can do for our patients?
Early ambulation.
Right. Good. Good. So acute post-op management. So, you know, as I said, they go home in about 2.2 days. So a lot of things can still happen when they go home. So I think it's important to talk about what things that are more common than not and what we should be aware of. Clearly, post-operative pneumonia and atelectasis, the incentive spirometer has helped greatly, giving them prior to surgery so they know how to use it. DVT prophylaxis, as we talked about. And actually, if they have a BMI greater than 60, we send them home on the enoxaparin. Incisional infections, that's more common in the open procedures, and it's more greatly influenced by blood sugar control, as we mm-hmm. talked about before. Nausea and vomiting, where we see not uncommon, about 10 to 15% of everybody will have some sort of nausea and vomiting. So on the medical side, we're very good at managing that. And the last thing that I think everybody should be aware of is the anastomotic leak. As I said earlier, it is very rare, but those are the ones that patients are going to get very sick very quickly. They don't have a lot of reserve, and so unless you're in tune with the signs and symptoms of an anastomotic leak, you can miss it. And as I said, they go home in about 2 to 3 days. The time for a leak is usually 2 to 7 days. So they may have gone home and still at a higher risk for the dreaded leak. So if we look at the cardinal symptoms of leaks, malaise, feverness, I think the most important one is shoulder pain. Specifically, left shoulder pain is a leak until proven otherwise. If we look at the signs of a leak, the signs, tachycardia. Anybody with tachycardia greater than 120 is a leak until proven otherwise. They really should not be tachycardic, even with pain. A heart rate greater than 120 is worrisome. And so if they're tachycardic, they need to be worked up. So I think any program, reputable program, will want them to come back to the hospital in the emergency room that did the procedure, because we're more attuned to that, and not going to a community hospital because they're just not attuned to that. So I think those are very, very important. The other things are not as sensitive nor specific, but the tachycardia is. So what we do, our livelihood is really the medical management of these surgeries, nausea, vomiting, dehydration, medical adjustments, nutrition supplements, laboratory testing postoperatively, psychological adaptations, because there's a lot of psychological adaptations that need to, that do go on and need to go on in the bariatric surgery patients postoperatively. And I think for a comprehensive program, you need to have relapse prevention, both for chronic disease but also for weight gain. So if we look at causes of nausea and vomiting, do you want to just talk about nausea and vomiting, because you're an expert in treating that?
Sure. Well, certainly a lot of the pain medications that patients are on after surgery can cause some nausea. And also patients after surgery, a lot of times are a little hesitant to start on the diet after surgery. And so it's very easy now for them with this small egg-sized pouch to get behind on their fluid status. Mm-hmm. So then they start to get a little dehydrated, and that dehydration causes a little more nausea, mm-hmm. which can lead to more dehydration. So they can very quickly get into sort of a downward spiral there. So we try to make sure that we are really emphasizing the need for them to get their fluids in after surgery.
Yeah, very important, very important. The other thing that we changed with Tasha's recommendation, we used to start the vitamins right when they went home, and there was a significant increase of nausea in patients that started the chewable vitamins. So we felt that the supplements were nutritionally balanced, that they didn't need them. Is that right?
Right. If they're taking 2 to 3 nutritional supplements a day, they're getting the recommended daily intake for their vitamins and minerals. So they can hold off on taking their vitamins. We recommend waiting till 4 weeks postoperatively.
Yep. Yeah, and that's really significantly decreased mm-hmm. that. You know, eating too, just behavioral changes that you try to instill in them preoperative, eating too quickly and or not chewing enough can lead to that.
So there's some little things that we try to get them to practice preoperatively, but using a sippy cup, like a child's sippy cup, to remind them to sip slowly, to get them to eat their yogurt slowly, toddler silverware and things like that. Set the timer on the stove so they try to make their fluids last, 8 ounces should last an hour. And setting the timer just to remind themselves to eat slowly is pretty effective.
Good. And then what I call small pouch syndrome, this is when the surgical operation is fine. They do upper GI and everything's fine, but they still can't tolerate PO. Mm-hmm. It's very frustrating for the patient. It's very frustrating for the providers. But a lot of times you just have to wait it out. Sometimes they need some parenteral nutrition and fluids. Sometimes we use Remeron. You know, Remeron's an antidepressant, but it also helps with sleep, and it also helps with appetite. So it's about 10% of individuals. It runs in waves, sort of type A personalities, and it seems like nursing supervisors or spouses of VIPs sort of get that. So sort of runs in spurts. But the key message is anybody unable to keep anything down for 24 hours needs to be seen in the emergency room for evaluation.